Yes, thank you very much for coming to the seminar series of the Sloan Schwartz Center for Theoretical Neurobiology. Today, we're very pleased to welcome Jack Cowan, who's visiting from the University of Chicago. Jack Cowan and I go way back. He reminded me that we first met 25 years ago at a meeting at Aspen. And I remember at that meeting that I was talking about, I had this crazy idea that correlations between spike trains might have something to do with brain function. And Jack had this crazy idea that patterns of activity in visual cortex might have something to do with the visual illusions. And interestingly enough, we're still working on the same problem. But in fact, Jack has been working on this problem for even longer. This, you're going to be hearing the fourth version, the fourth incarnation of a very, I think, compelling idea, and it gets better every time. It's like a fine wine. If you wait long enough, there are new nuances. Now, Jack, actually, his training goes back to MIT. He was present at the creation. He knew Warren McCulloch, for example, who was one of the pioneers in this field, and he knew Norbert Wiener. And it was the training there, and then eventually at University of Chicago, where he was the director of one of the first departments or programs in theoretical biology that really got the field off the ground. And so we're very, very happy that he's coming back and to tell us about some recent work he's done on visual illusions, visual hallucinations. He's going to give another talk tomorrow at 10 a.m. in the same rooms, and it's going to be on a field theoretic approach to analyzing networks, and he tells me that he's now solved the problem that I was working on 25 years ago, so I'm looking forward to the lecture. Jack.
It took me 25 years, though. apropos of that, I once asked Dick Feynman why he had never had any graduate students. This was at Aspen that same year you were there. We were having lunch, and he looked at me with a twinkle in his eye, and he said, well, the reason is the following. If it's a problem they can solve in 3 or 4 years, I can solve it in 10 minutes. If I can't solve it in 10 minutes, they're never going to get it. So I've often thought of that problem because I spent 40 years working on trying to do the statistical mechanics of neural networks. And so tomorrow I'll talk to you about that story. And it does answer some of Terry's the interesting questions he raised in his PhD thesis. But today I want to talk about another subject, which is actually very closely related to tomorrow's talk, too, in a way. And this is the subject of spontaneous pattern formation in the cortex. So one of the things that I think is very interesting about the cortex and any network, actually, is that it's capable of spontaneous pattern formation under many conditions. So there's a generative aspect to the nervous system, which I think is not paid enough attention to. I think the nervous system is capable of producing all kinds of altered states, patterns. And the way spontaneous pattern formation occurs is by what physicists call spontaneous symmetry breaking. If you have a system that's sitting in some equilibrium, suppose it's a completely featureless equilibrium, in other words, no pattern, but that state becomes unstable, and if the system is appropriately configured and has some nonlinearities in it, then patterns emerge. And those patterns have less symmetry than the original uniform state. So physicists say the symmetry is broken. And so you get spontaneously broken symmetry. And it turns out this is a very important property systems that physicists have used, for example, the way in which particles get their mass in particle physics is by this same mechanism. And for Alan Guth's theory about the inflation, the early inflation of the universe, depends critically on this idea. So in my opinion, it's a key idea that one should follow. And my approach to theoretical neuroscience, to trying to think about the brain, is different from most people's. Most people's are driven correctly by data. Mine is driven by mathematical ideas of symmetry and pattern formation, spontaneous symmetry breaking, stuff like that. I don't get interested in stuff unless it has things like that in it, that you can get a handle on, concepts that you can use to drive your research. So I'm a great believer in what Einstein used to talk about, that you really have to have beautiful equations in order for them to say things about nature. I really think that's true about biology as well, although it's not apparent yet in cells or in organisms or in the brain that could be a useful way to attack things, but I believe it ultimately will be a useful way. And so in 1977, I was at a meeting in Bavaria, in Schloss Elmau, organized by Hermann Haken, German theoretical physicist, on pattern formation. And there was a mathematician there who gave a beautiful talk on symmetry in Rayleigh-Baynard fluid convection. You know that if you heat a liquid from below, a viscous liquid, and you look at it, it starts to make convection patterns. And the patterns aren't initially random. They're organized. They're either in the form of stripes or in the form of hexagons. And these were discovered by Baynard at the turn of the 20th century and have been studied a great deal ever since. At that time, there was a Scientific American article by Ralph Siegel from the VA hospital in Los Angeles on geometric visual hallucinations. And what he showed was that many people under a variety of conditions report seeing tunnels and funnels and lattice patterns. I'll show you the pictures shortly. And I suddenly realized that if you took those patterns and subjected them to the retinocortical map, which had been worked out independently of me by Eric Schwartz, but I had also done something similar. He showed that there was a logarithmic map from the visual field to the visual cortex. But if you took these patterns that people report seeing and subject them to such a map, they turn into Rayleigh-Baynard patterns in visual cortex. Once I saw that, I was very fortunate in having a really smart graduate student, Bart Ehrmantraut. And between us, we constructed a Model 1, a first version of the story of how the nervous system might actually generate the patterns people see. But it was clear over the years that that model was just scratching the surface of the problem. And in fact, once you start on if you're really interested in trying to do a proper story on it, you find yourself being led deeper and deeper and deeper into the nervous system and into the mathematics. So it's for me, it's always been a compelling story. So this is what I want to start to look at. So here's the basic story. Heinrich Kluger, in 1928, wrote a monograph based on his own experience. He would take peyote, and after the initial vomiting period, he began to see hallucinatory images. And he ended up classifying them. And so here are the classification, the tunnels and the funnels. There was a biophysicist named Gerald Oster at Albert Einstein who took LSD and painted what he saw and eventually sold all his paintings in New York. Christopher Tyler showed that if you use deep binocular pressure on your eyeballs, a number of people will see checkerboard patterns. If you look at rock carvings from way back, you can see petroglyphs that show indications of hallucinatory images. And finally, if you ingest things like psilocybin, you also begin to see characteristic patterns. And everybody seems to see these things. Almost everyone sees the same kinds of patterns. And so Heinrich Kluber called them form constants and classified them. And there are basically four kinds of images with different kinds of patterns associated with them. And part of this talk will show you that out of the anatomy of the visual cortex, the mathematics tells us that such an anatomy can only make four kinds of patterns when it goes unstable, and that there are exactly these patterns. So there's a nice piece of useful mathematics here. If you look at anthropologists have actually been interested recently in the idea that a lot of the rock carvings and cave paintings actually are hallucinatory in origin. So here's some stuff from 77,000 years before the present and earlier, where people started carving things that are in the class of images that people call hallucinatory. And more recently, there's paintings from a lot more recently, which are thought to have been triggered by hallucinatory images or possibly by migraine images. Kinds of fortification illusions in migraine that Oliver Sacks has talked about at length are similar to these kinds of pictures. So for those of you here, I don't need to do the physiological or anatomical background. What we are concentrating on is the idea that since there's a retinotopic map from the visual field to V1 and to some extent to V2, it's those areas that are responsible for the spontaneous formation of these patterns, even though there might be involvement of higher areas as well in the process. Here's the brain for mathematicians that I like to show to a mathematics audience, which is the level of complexity that we really can handle. And here's Roger Toutel's 2-deoxyglucose autoradiograph of a pattern in the visual field onto the visual cortex, indicating that there really is a topographic map from the visual field to the surface of visual cortex. And if you, there are various ways of calculating the form of that map. What I did was I simply took the packing density of retinal ganglion cells in the human retina and used that to drive the topographic map and found the logarithmic transformation that Eric Schwartz had worked out. And it has a very nice and fundamental property here, is that logarithmic spiral contours in the visual field become oblique straight lines in the visual cortex. That really is the key to the idea. And so it was natural when I had this idea about Rayleigh-Baynard to think about the mechanisms for generating stripes and hexagons or blobs in nature. And of course, Turing's work, the 1952 paper on the chemical basis of morphogenesis, in which he took diffusion-coupled chemical reactions, an activator and an inhibitor, and showed that if the diffusion constants for the two substances were differed, then he could make spot patterns in the two-dimensional geometry and ultimately also stripe patterns. Now, Turing didn't really know enough nonlinear mathematics to do any real analysis on the problem. He was able to do the linear analysis, but he wasn't able to carry out the nonlinear work. But that was done subsequently in the years since 1952. So what Ehrmantraut and I recognized was that we could set up a version of the mean field equations I introduced earlier with Hugh Wilson to actually replicate the details of Turing's model in a neural context. And what we require essentially is a Mexican hat-like interaction in a two-dimensional cortical model. In other words, local excitation and lateral inhibition, or the opposite. As long as the two length scales differ, that's all that's necessary to produce spots or stripes in a two-dimensional geometry. Now, the thing that controls whether you get spots or stripes is the nature of the threshold function. Whether it's sitting about an inflection point in a symmetric fashion or not determines whether or not you see spots or stripes. So it's an exact analog of Rayleigh-Baynard fluid convection. And the details are very straightforward. I put up the slide, but I don't need you to follow the slide. But all you have to do is linearize about an equilibrium, realize that the equation has a symmetry associated with it. Because the weight function doesn't change wherever you are in the cortex, it means that there's a translation symmetry associated with that. That means that the symmetry group for the cortex is the group of rigid body motions in the plane. You can go anywhere you like in the cortex and you'll still see the same structure. That's the idea. And that is called by mathematicians Euclidean symmetry of the plane, E2, the symmetry group of those transformations. And once you know that, you basically, the job is done, because mathematically, once you know there's a Euclidean symmetry group there, you know the subgroups of that of such a symmetry group, and the patterns that correspond to those subgroups are stripes and blobs. And those subgroups determine the patterns that form when the homogeneous state goes unstable. It's a very simple and straightforward theory. We leave out the stimulus to study the spontaneous pattern formation, and we do the usual calculation. And the main thing is to calculate what is the wavelength of the patterns that emerge. And the wavelength depends upon the space constants for excitation and inhibition. So if you build in the appropriate space constants, you can produce patterns with a given wavelength. And if you look at Hubel and Wiesel's cytoarchitectonics papers from the Journal of Comparative Neurology, 1974, you get all the information you need to determine that, and some more modern work on human cortex. Basically, the wavelength in the human cortex is 2 millimeters. So basically, the cortex likes to make 2 millimeter waves when it goes unstable under the action of hallucinogens on the brainstem, and produces 2 millimeter spaced patterns. Under the retinocortical map, these things turn into the cleaver form constants. And you can calculate, depending on whether you have a simple threshold nonlinearity or a more complicated nonlinearity, you can control whether you make stripes or hexagons, which are blob patterns in two-dimensional geometry. So basically, the tunnels become stripes with a vertical orientation in the cortex, the funnels become stripes with a horizontal, and the spirals become stripes with an oblique orientation in the cortex. And all these things are produced spontaneously depending upon the initial conditions. But the form, you cannot account for the honeycomb and the checkerboard, the cobweb patterns that are all very characteristic with that model, because it's basically treating the cortex as if it were a retina. And we know from Hubel and Wiesel onward that the cortex, of course, has feature detectors that do much more complex things than just detect spot patterns the way the retina does.
Checkerboard pattern by a superposition of spirals.
You can't really, no. You still get, you can't generate thin line contoured patterns like this with the first model. So what you need is to build a model built from orientation tuned cells. And so these slides just show some of the details of the tuning curves and the distribution of orientation preferences in the cortex. I'm sure most of you are familiar with this. And of course, with modern work, however, pioneered by Gary Blaisdell and others, one began to see that the architecture of the cortex was a lot more complex than Hubel and Wiesel's 1974 models would have made it. And so one has to ultimately grapple with the real complexity of the orientation distribution in the cortex. So how are we to do that? Well, it turns out that anatomy has gave us the clues that we need. So if you look at a combination of optical imaging with staining techniques, Bosking et al. And Blaisdell et al. Discovered, this is David Fitzpatrick's work, of course, the left one, that the lateral connections, horizontal connections in the cortex, are highly anisotropic. And what is interesting is they discovered that the direction of the anisotropy of the connectivity, the local lateral connections in the cortex, lies parallel to the orientation preference of the cells of origin of the axons. And so then I realized in about 1993 or so, I think these were published later, but Wiesel and others had actually, and Gilbert and Wiesel had discovered this earlier with just anatomical measurements. I realized that there was a new symmetry associated with these connections, which we called the, just found the symmetry. And the symmetry is the following. If you have this kind of anisotropic connection, you're pointing in a given direction, the wiring that is along that direction, and that direction is the orientation preference. Now you go to another set of cells with this orientation preference. Well, you just have to rotate the frame so it's parallel with the new orientation. So that is a different symmetry. The weight pattern is unchanged under two things. You change the label for the weights, but you also change the direction of the weight pattern. And now it turns out that Zwick and Williams, University of New Mexico, for completely different reasons, had come up with this symmetry to construct basis functions to preserve contour completion when you discretize a continuous system. And if you want to preserve Euclidean symmetry in the plane, you have to have this symmetry in it. And they called it shift-twist symmetry. And so what I had discovered was that the shift-twist symmetry is sitting in this weight pattern. Now that changes it's still the Euclidean group in the plane, but the way it's generated is completely different and novel for mathematicians. And so so here's the circuitry that you end up with for the shift-twist symmetry in it. Things that signal the same orientation preference are connected laterally in the visual cortex. And that symmetry represented a very interesting problem for a distinguished mathematician who I started collaborating with. That was Marty Golubitsky, who is one of the world's experts on symmetry in nonlinear dynamics. And so Marty Golubitsky and my other collaborator, Paul Breslov, and I, and my students, Peter Thomas, who was here as a postdoc, and Matt Wiener, we basically constructed a new model. And this model embodies this shift-twist symmetry in the lateral connections. And it tells us now that the connectivity is not the simple Mexican hat connectivity that Ehrmantraut and I introduced, which is isotropic. But you add a little perturbative term to it, which is the anisotropic lateral connectivity between all the different edge detectors. And so then the next step is simply to analyze that. And so what you do is you, again, do linear stability analysis. But now you find that there's extra terms because of the lateral connectivity that turn it into a much harder problem to deal with. Paul Breslov turned out to be an expert on these kinds of problems because it turns out it's exactly the problem of calculating the weak field Zeeman effect in physics. You put a magnetic system in a weak magnetic field and you get things orienting in certain directions. And mathematically, that's what this problem is. So immediately, we could use the methods of quantum mechanics to solve this perturbation problem and calculate what was happening in the cortex. And it's called degenerate Rayleigh-Schrodinger perturbation theory. And what it showed is that if you don't switch on the lateral connections, the pattern formation produces both even and odd waves, cosine waves and sine waves, in other words, phase shifted by 90 degrees. And so you got a mixture of these things, but as soon as the lateral connections turn on, it splits the degeneracy of the solution. You get either the cosine ones, the even ones, or you get the sine ones, the odd ones. That's exactly what the Zeeman effect is in physics, splitting the eigenvalue degenerate solutions and producing a unique solution to the problem. The thing is magnetized in one direction rather than another. So our system is just like a set of little magnets, which is very interesting. And again, you can calculate how the connectivity determines whether you get the even or the odd eigenmodes. And here's what the patterns look like. In the cortex, the even ones are shown on the left and the odd ones on the right. And now if you map them back to the visual field, you see an interesting thing. The even ones are the contour-completing ones and correspond to the form constants of Cleaver's classification. The other ones don't, but people who know have told me that the one on the far right is actually something that people who suffer from effects of alcohol, alcoholic deliriums and things like that, they tend to see these things. So there's something quite interesting about these patterns. But for our purposes, it's the even eigenfunctions that are important. So now we can make use of, let me just go back there a minute. We actually can make use of a little theorem that Marty Golubitsky and Schaefer produced that tells us the following. If you have a system with a symmetry, and it's described by a symmetry group, such a symmetry groups have subgroups, systems, patterns with lower symmetry than the initial one. An axial subgroup is a subgroup which leaves only one planform invariant. And so every group has a set of axial subgroups. What Golubitsky and Schaefer proved was that if a dynamical system has a symmetry group and it goes unstable, the patterns that emerge correspond to the planforms left invariant by the axial subgroups. So we calculated the axial subgroups of the cortex under the shift-twist action, found that there were four such subgroups, and calculated what the planforms are that are left invariant by this action, and they correspond to the four Cleaver form constants. So I think it's a very, very neat result. The symmetry group analysis tells us where the form constants are coming from. However, there's much more represented in the cortex than just orientation preference. There's also spatial frequency preferences, there's disparity direction preference, and there's also color sitting in the cortex. Now, whether it's sitting just in V1 is open, but nonetheless, there are feature preferences everywhere. And the question is, how do you go about building in all these other properties? Well, the first thing we looked at was spatial frequency. And it turns out Noam Issa, working in on this problem in Mike Stryker's lab, they showed that there is actually a highly organized spatial frequency map that's in register with the orientation preference map. This is something that other people had done earlier. Bonhoeffer's group had found for low spatial frequencies such a map, but the Stryker group found it for high spatial frequencies as well. And so here's the data. Bonhoeffer showed that half the pinwheels of the orientation map are surrounded by regions of low spatial frequency preference. And by inference, the pinwheels that are not surrounded are probably surrounded by high spatial frequency preferences. And that's essentially what Issa and company actually found in the cat. And so the question is, what kind of model could one construct to represent this? Now, the model that model 2, the one I just showed you, has basically eigenfunctions that are sines or cosines. It's basically a version of what some of you will know as the ring model. It's a system of coupled ring models. And so it has eigenvalues on the circle, which are just sines and cosines. The question is, what are the eigenvalues one would use if you had both orientation and spatial frequency maps associated with each other? And our answer was that there should be the eigenfunctions associated with the sphere. that we put orientation and spatial frequency on a sphere. So here was model three. We write an equation now in which we have at each point in the cortex an orientation preference and a spatial frequency preference, and we assume the geometry of a hypercolumn corresponds to a sphere. So around the equator, you have differing orientation tuning preferences, and as you move up and down the sphere from the south pole to the north pole, you go from high spatial frequency to low spatial frequency. And if you do this, you can map the cortex onto this. And then all you have to do is calculate the symmetry breaking now. And it's very similar to the coupled ring. It's now just coupled spheres. And instead of sines and cosines, you have spherical harmonics, because they're the eigenfunctions of the sphere. And it works. It works very well. And instead of thin lines, you get thin through thick lines interacting with each other and producing all the hallucinatory constants, and there's more to the story. But then came the problem: how do you generalize? How do you go from orientation and spatial frequency to include also disparity, direction preference, and color, emotion, stuff like that? And so I first tried. Well, Paul and I came across some papers which dealt with what are called hyperspherical harmonics, the eigenfunctions of things that live not on an ordinary two-sphere, as we call it, something that the surface of the sphere is two-dimensional, but suppose we had a three-dimensional object that's the surface of a four-dimensional thing. Well, that's a hypersphere. And you can actually write hyperspherical harmonics and generalize this whole story. And mathematically, it's beautiful. It's just the same theory, but except now it's in higher dimensions. Problem is, it doesn't work. Because why is that? Well, because the sphere has two singularities, and they correspond to the orientation pinwheels, a high frequency and a low frequency pinwheel. But if you go to hyperspheres, they have all kinds of singularities that don't exist in the feature maps that you see in the cortex. So although it's a beautiful idea, it doesn't work. So after a lot of thought, I decided that we had to go back to the first model I introduced with Bard. And it's quite interesting to think about this question, because what I did when I introduced this model originally, I made orientation preference, the phi variable here, a coordinate, just like r, the position. And then we introduced theta, the spatial frequency preference, as another coordinate. So what we were doing was a bit like general relativity. We made these preferences part of the coordinate system, so they distort the local geometry. Whereas the first setup I had with Bard, we only had position, so we had a flat Euclidean space and nothing else. So then I added these coordinates, but that distorted the geometry. But it doesn't work in higher dimensions. So what I did was I went back to the first model with Bard-Ehrmantraut, just a flat space with Euclidean symmetry, and then introduced the feature preferences just as maps onto that space, but not in a way that changes the coordinates. In other words, it was going back to Newtonian-like ways of doing it rather than Einsteinian ways of doing it. It's basically the same set of notions that are there. Because we know that all these additional maps, cortical maps to try to handle. So what I want to do now is to give you an outline of how this new theory works. It actually works. It's clear it works. But we've only done it for orientation. So this is the content now of Tanya Baker's work and thesis. I mean, here's the fact that there's also ocular dominance in the story that you have to build in as well, and there are very nice ways, and CO blob patterns, and there are very nice ways of putting all these things together now. But let me go back to the... So here's the new model. It's really the old model, but we've now added as a perturbation to the old model the long-range connections between features. So on top of the simple model I introduced with Bard-Ehrmantraut, there's now an extra perturbing term, but it's perturbing in a different way to the ring model perturbation. We're building the perturbation in a different way. And we're building in an idea that occurred to us that, in my opinion, we should have seen a lot earlier. If you look at the Hubel-Weissel pictures, and you look at Blaisdell and Fitzpatrick and so on, all the patterns that people produce, they're effectively they're nearly periodic. So what they're telling us is that a really good way to look at the visual cortex is to treat it as if it's crystal-like, that it's real. So we wrote a paper entitled "The Visual Cortex as a Crystal," and that triggered Paul, to realize that if it's true that the visual cortex is a crystal, then we can use the methods of condensed matter physics for treating crystals. In other words, to introduce a Bloch wave representation of everything in the cortex in terms of periodic waves, Bloch waves, as they're called by physicists. And so we introduced a Bloch wave representation of all this stuff we're doing, which means you can do Fourier analysis on all the things. And if you do that, you find that what the effect of the perturbation is doing, was before we had this analogy with the magnetic field, now if we put the thing into crystalline form, it means that the lateral connections, so if you didn't have the lateral connections, you still get Turing patterns, but the Turing patterns wouldn't know where to fit in this crystal. As soon as you put in the long range, the lateral connections, however, they pin the Turing patterns so they sit correctly in the crystal. And so what's actually happening in the cortex, according to this idea, is that the interactions of the lateral connections are actually pinning, setting the phase of the spontaneously formed patterns that form because of the local connections and the Mexican hat-like local architecture. They're pinning them in various ways. And so what Tanya Baker did was so Paul actually carried out an analysis on how pinning occurs to cytochrome oxidase blob arrangements. They pin the ocular dominance patterns, and the even patterns pin them in such a way that they pin they avoid the edges of the ocular dominance, avoid the CO blobs. But the other solution is when the edges of the ocular dominance patterns actually line up with the CO blobs. And if you look carefully in the cortex, you'll see examples of both of these, not just one, as people used to think. And it turns out if you can apply exactly the same idea to orientation preferences. So here's the idea. You've got the Mexican hat, local connectivity, and now you've got this periodic structure that's created by the lateral connections, the crystal nature of the hypercolumn interactions in the cortex. And if you arrange them so they line up with each other, then you get pinning. They fit together, you get pinning. And so, but they don't always pin the whole structure. You get dislocations, and these are called solitons, and you get the whole array of the Sine-Gordon equation and all the things that condensed matter physicists have done applies directly to the visual cortex and beyond. And so Tanya carried out a series of simulations. She first did it with a one-dimensional model. And what you find is that if you've got no lateral connections, you just get patterns forming they're somewhat randomly phased. But as soon as you put in the appropriate small perturbation produced by the lateral connections, now things line up and correctly in phase, and the structure, it becomes pinned. And so if you keep doing that, and it takes time before the pinning actually works, it's a dynamic process, and then eventually you see the whole thing pins nicely in spatiotemporal dimension. And as you vary the strength of the lateral coupling, or you vary the change, you find that you get little regions where you pin to one phase and then you pin to the other. In between there's a dislocation, and that's what is called a soliton. And so you can actually analyze these things exactly by this, the whole theory. And it works very beautifully. You get no phase, and then you can do it in two dimensions. So here's a Turing pattern of stripes, but it's quite noisy because there's no lateral connections to pin it. And here's what the effect when you have a weak lateral connectivity. It pins right on, exactly onto the stripes, as it should. And so here's a 2D simulation where you've got spots rather than stripes being made. And again, if you have a little lateral connectivity, it pins correctly to the right place. So this shows a simulation of the thing here. Here you've got pinning to two distinct orientation preferences. And so here you can actually see the thing at work. So it takes a little while to build up. The Turing pattern, the noise amplifies, begins to amplify, and eventually it'll start in a few seconds. And you'll see how it pins. So the red and the blue are two different orientation preferences in this geometry, two-dimensional geometry. And here, there it starts to build now, the pattern. And light is regions of high activity. And it rapidly pins. And you begin to see that there's competition between the two orientations for the pattern. And eventually it settles where in one region you have the one orientation and there's some and in the other region another, and then there's some competition between the two and the third region. And you have dislocations between the regions, just as you would expect from the theory. And you can do that with three orientation preferences as well, in a hexagonal lattice. And again, there's a little simulation of it. So now there are three orientations in the system. And again, it takes a little while to build. Eventually it will take off again. And again, it builds and you start to see pinning effects in the system and dislocations from this. Well, if it's not commensurate with the Turing pattern wavelength, then you'll have some problems. So you have to tune it so that all things are as commensurate as possible. Well, for a particular space constant, there's a particular set of lateral architectures that will fit with it. There's a big problem in there, which, you can... you can do all sorts of things in here, which I'll comment on. Now, if you actually look at these pin solutions, when you have two orientation preferences, here's what it's actually doing in the visual field. It's pinning. You're getting pinning to the two different orientations and competition between the two. But there's an arbitrary phase in this whole story at the moment. And so if you rotate by any constant angle, you'll get another pattern out of this, which again is competition between two, but now instead of being circles and tunnels and funnels, it's spirals. So there's a little bit of arbitrariness in the story. The same here is another pattern on the hexagonal lattice, and you can rotate it a little bit in the cortex and it'll produce a different looking pattern. And then what Tanya did was she looked at Gary Blaisdell's experimental data and abstracted out of Gary's pictures some lateral connectivity just by measuring the lightness and darkness of the image. And then she set up a model in two dimensions with Dirichlet boundary conditions of things with the connectivity switched on, and found that there was some preferences for different orientations in that little patch of cortex that Gary analyzed with optical imaging, And here's basically what Gary's data shows. With no lateral interactions, everything is random, but as soon as the lateral interactions switch on, you begin to see things lining up. Now, what's interesting about this is, some of these solutions are quite stable for very long times, but because there's really a phase transition going on in here, you get what's called critical slowing down. It takes a very long time for them to actually anneal to a final pattern, which is as little disorder as possible in it. So all the phenomenology of that you see in condensed matter physics, you see in these cortical models. Let me just make one point. It's quite clear that there are more than three orientation preferences in each local region in the cortex. We know that you can only fit no more than three orientations into a periodic lattice on a two-dimensional geometry. So what happens if we try to fit more orientations? Now, there's some very, very interesting work going on what are called quasicrystals in the last few years, and it's not. And it turns out that if you have a random number of orientations, and you just try to use thermodynamic methods to arrive at a structure that minimizes some quantity, they generally tend to end up ordered as in a quasicrystal. In other words, with an n-fold symmetry mapped onto the plane locally. And I think that's what's actually happening in the cortex. So we're actually in the middle of trying to do the analysis now, assuming that the cortex is not a periodic structure, but is a quasi-periodic structure. So that will be the next model, Model 5. So let me, in the final few minutes, just indicate for you how you can actually build in all the other feature preferences into the story. Because there's nothing in this model with the Euclidean symmetry confined to the position vector. There's nothing that precludes our using the feature maps for any other feature preference in the story. And so here we had orientation and spatial frequency. And the point that I want to make is that if you actually have an input, an input to the cortex, and that's defined by an orientation and a spatial frequency as well as a position, if you project that input onto the spherical harmonics that are in the coupled sphere model, you find you can always express the input and the filter, the feature that detects such inputs, just as the scalar product of two quantities. In other words, every tuning curve, in a suitable representation, every tuning curve just looks like a cosine function. That's what it means. And you can do that for any representation. So here I just show how you can actually do that using the Dirac notation for vectors and matrices. But basically, all you do, if you just project out the zeroth and first order basis functions for any set of inputs and networks, then it means that you can uniformly represent any system of feature detectors in terms of basis vectors. So if you have basis vectors that are sines and cosines, you can represent orientation. If you have basis vectors that are spherical harmonics, you can represent orientation and spatial frequency as dot products. But it doesn't matter what basis function you use, you can always represent these things as dot products. But by dot products means it's basically a cosine tuning curve. So you can represent tuning curves for color, disparity, etc., all in the same way. So here, if you take Ning Chin's a slightly modified version of Ning Chin's way of setting up binocular disparity receptive fields, you have two slightly different views of the world, and you combine them. You've got a left eye and a right eye view, and you've got an ocular dominance in the story. That's what the distribution N, L, and NR are. And you can build up a little receptive field like that. And if you build it from Gaussian cosine-modulated Gaussians, you find that the cortical input is basically a cosine. And so you get a tuning curve for disparity out of this, which is a cosine. But now it's exactly the same argument that we did before for orientation and spatial frequency. So we can make, so we can inversely map from our cortical model with features given by disparity back into the visual field in exactly the same way we've done before. And so I haven't actually produced the pictures yet, but we can do it. It's quite clear we can do it for all any feature now. So next time I come here, I'll show you basically hallucinations of in-depth motion and color. And it's quite clear that the so-called near-death experience, for example, where people report seeing themselves falling down a tunnel with light at the end of it, is nothing more than one of these patterns on the cortex, but involving feature detectors of features of a number of different colors. And so this brings me to the final story. I was always intrigued by, something Francis Crick said to me once, although he claimed that Jim Watson originated. He said to me once, he said, no theory should fit all the facts because not all the facts are right. And I always thought that was a typical Francis story. So if you take this, an artist painted this lattice tunnel hallucination, as a representation of what many people had told him. And if you look at it, you see it's got depth in it, it's got spirals, it's got color, all kinds of interesting things in it. And the simple theory that we've got didn't seem to be capable of generating such a thing. But by chance, we tried to represent a hexagonal pattern on a square lattice. But these two things are not commensurate. They don't. So what do you get? Happens, you get these solitons, these dislocations in the thing. We saw that in our computer simulation, that you got all these dislocations, and they begin to look like this pattern that people report seeing. So it's quite clear now that if we actually have a hallucination that involves depth, disparity, and color, disparity in color and orientation and spatial frequency, there will be solitons in the story, in the pinning thing, and we will actually be able to generate stuff like this right off from this model now. So the next model, model 5, will actually contain this. And then, as I'll show you tomorrow, you can actually take a completely different approach to all of this stuff by embedding all this way of thinking into a statistical mechanics treatment where the effects of fluctuations and the correlation things in the story actually come in and control even more what's going on. So there'll be a model 6 and 7 eventually. Hopefully I'll live long enough to do all that. Well, thanks very much for listening.
Yes.
So lateral connections are common in other sensory systems as well.
Yes.
Are there other kinds of hallucinations that have been described?
Well, there are. It's hard to pin them down because the visual ones have so much geometric structure to them that you can really work on them. So there are auditory hallucinations. I have a few tapes of Native Americans who are playing music and having auditory hallucinations that I got actually from Byron Goldstein at Los Alamos, and they're very, very interesting. But since we don't know really the details of the feature, the way in which auditory features are represented, it's hard to pin down the story. There are also gustatory hallucinations and somatosensory hallucinations. Dick Feynman once told me that he spent one summer every day getting into an isolation tank because he was working on memory. He figured if he allowed his mind to drift, he would be able to begin to understand memory. And at the end of the summer, I asked him if he'd solved the problem. He said no, but he felt relaxed and clean. but he said he hallucinated a lot while he was in there. And in particular, he felt an object crawling up his gut, a gustatory hallucination. So. And then there are what are called formication hallucinations. That's an M, where people feel their skin crawling in lattice patterns. And yes. Yeah.
How are olfactory hallucinations?
I think they exist, but I...
A sign of, well, it's schizophrenia.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of phenomenology there. Migraines.
Epilepsy, migraines.
Yeah, I'll show you that in a minute. But
just a quick question. I understand after erratic patterns on the cortex, the log transformation might produce this sort of stuff, but I don't understand how I can predict Chris Tyler's ocular pressure hallucination, since that's really a retinal.
Well, I don't think it's retinal. I think it's geniculate.
Well, how do you push on your eyes?
Well, it doesn't work if you just push on one eye. You have to push on both eyes. It's binocular pressure. It's not monocular pressure. You don't see them with monocular pressure.
The pressure, are you saying that it's like hydraulic and it gets pushed into the shadow?
No, but if you press on an eyeball, it triggers hyperactive activity in ganglion cells.
So
it's partly retinal, of course, but you actually need a binocular effect in order to see the checkerboard patterns. It looks like it's geniculate. I was going to talk a little bit about migraine. Here's what a migraine fortification pattern of migraine looks like. And I had... let's see if I can... maybe this one. Waste time. But if you look at that picture, let's cover that just now. Bernard Hassenstein in Germany, one of Werner Reichardt's collaborators, used to have a visual migraine about once a month for quite a few years. So he measured his migraines for me. So he sat down and he had an assistant plot the leading edge of the disturbance in the visual field as a function of time. And this is the graph he sent me. And if you, so that's the visual angle as a function of minutes. And if you replot that in cortical coordinates under the retinocortical transform, it turns into a straight line with a slope of about 1.5 millimeters per minute. So it's a very different phenomenon from these hallucinations. Reports are that hallucinations start with a bright white light. You see white light, and then in about 3 seconds, you see an image covering the whole of the visual field. So that's a propagation velocity of the order of centimeters per second, which is more like an epileptic seizure than it is a migraine. In fact, I think hallucinations are... epileptic seizures and hallucinations are instabilities in the same setup. One corresponds to bifurcation at a simple eigenvalue. That's what when you get these stationary patterns and hallucinations. The other corresponds to bifurcation at a complex eigenvalue where you get waves and moving patterns and rotating waves and spirals and stuff like that. And I think that's much more characteristic of seizures. And so, but these things are different. They're moving at millimeters per minute. So they're much more closely related to spreading depression, for example, stuff like that. But interestingly, if you take some of the pictures I showed before, in particular, Tanya's pictures where you don't have the lateral connections at work, but only the local stuff, you find that things will look very disordered. And there's no long-range order in the system. So if I had a traveling wavefront that was exciting a bit of cortex, moving at 1.5 millimeters per minute, and it's not turning on the lateral connectivity, but just some local stuff, you're going to see exactly these patterns. So I now have a model for these things that just comes straight out of Tanya's calculations of the ocular dominance. It's not dissimilar to something Peter Muller published a couple of years ago, which he took Blaisdell's data and constructed a fortification illusion from it. But here we have a much more detailed treatment of it from the mathematical side and derived it directly. So it's quite interesting to see the kinds of things that you can get out of this model. Here's another one of these pictures, and There's all kinds of pictures that people report seeing. Here's the famous one from the turn of the 20th century. Gowers was reading, and all of a sudden he noticed a scotoma in his visual field, which got bigger and bigger and bigger, and left behind a refractory trail before it cleaned up again. And it's quite clear that this is the same kind of thing that we're talking about. So there's a lot to be had from doing the mathematics of all this kind of stuff, and making models of it. Whether it's got anything to do with the computation is another question. But
so in the case of, say, LSD, right? So that's influencing the neuromodulatory.
Yes, it's working systems. On serotonin and noradrenaline systems.
Right, and that probably is blocking potassium currents, which is causing the cells to depolarize. So this is an instability. In other words, you have a balance. The network normally is in a balanced condition,
right.
And suddenly...
Right.
You're taking it out of that balance.
Yeah, and that means it's you've made the equilibrium state unstable. And so tomorrow I'll try to shed some light on how to calculate what goes on under those conditions when you remove the balance.
By the way, in this case there's kind of a scotoma, but for people who are seeing illusions, are they blind to everything else that's out there, or is it superimposed?
Illusions or hallucinations? Okay, so I have a paper in here where I talk about it in the Phil Trans paper. So Heinrich Cleaver made a study of this among other people, and it turns out there's competition. There's three things. There's competition between perceiving the outside world when you're hallucinating, and if you create after images, there's competition between seeing the after image and the hallucination as well. So interestingly, there's competition for attention among these three these things. And you can be aware of one of them, and the other will upset your awareness and so on.
Case that's global, it's either in one, like a binocular rivalry, was either you see the background or you see the...
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes it seems to be like that. And it's quite interesting. We have to do this, but to construct these hallucinations in depth. Yeah, I've been informed that people, when stereo images are stabilized in the visual field and don't move with the eyes. But these and of course after images move with the eyes. So the reports on hallucinations is that they seemed to be stabilized. So which Bob Shapley feels is evidence against this theory of mine that they're in V1. So it's an open question what might be happening really. But I think the fact that under the retinocortical map these things become so simple in the form of patterns argues strongly that there must be involved in V1 and probably V2, but there might be something else going on as well to stabilize them.
Can you induce a specific pattern of hallucination with a transient input of light with the appropriate type?
You can, but it's dangerous because, as I mentioned, hallucinations are simply a bifurcation of a certain kind, and epilepsy is a bifurcation of another kind. And so if you subject people to looking at high contrast gratings of the right spatial frequency and the right flicker frequency, a number of people will start to hallucinate, but many people will actually start to have a seizure. So it's very dangerous to try that experiment.
So Bart Ehrlichraut once came to a Woods Hole meeting with an LSD simulator. Have you ever seen this?
No, he hasn't tried it on me.
It's a long tube. And on the other tube is a little thing that rotates that chops the light.
And
you put it up at the sun and you rotate it.
Yeah.
And then after a while you start seeing these cobwebs and things.
Yeah.
So you're telling me that was inducing epileptic seizures?
Possibly, yeah.
I should have known when I looked at his hand and saw a couple of his fingers were missing.
So I had a very interesting experience that way. I once went to Boston University to visit your friend Nancy Capel, who always turns white when I mention your name. But anyway, I went to see Gail Carpenter because Steve wouldn't see me. But anyway, Gail was wearing, it was a bright sunny day, I was sitting in Gail's office, and she was wearing a very high contrast striped dress. And so help me, I started to feel uncomfortable every time I looked at her dress, because I was starting to get have a little bit of an aura. I was clear that it was actually triggering something. So,
why is it you were averting your eyes?
No, she was wondering why I was looking at her dress all the time.
You're doing an experiment.
Yeah, I was doing an experiment, all in the cause of science. But so it's clear that flicker-induced epilepsy is... In Britain, they used to have the approaches to bridges painted with black and white stripes. But they had so many people report having auras as they drove their cars over in bright sunlight that they had to stop that for that reason. So I regard epilepsy and hallucinations as two sides of the fact that the nervous system is normally sitting in a balanced condition, and that anything that disrupts that will start to produce these spontaneous effects and alter the state of the cortex. The other thing I take from this is Gary Blaisdell has always insisted to me that the visual cortex is not special, that if you look at other parts of the neocortex, you'll see similar architecture there. He doesn't think that the architecture of visual cortex is atypical, but in fact it's typical, and therefore if the cortex is really the visual cortex is a quasi-crystal, so should the rest of the brain be a quasi-crystal, and it might be possible to bring this kind of analysis to bear on everywhere. So that's one of my fantasies, that it might be possible to do that.
You have some hallucinations going on right
now? No, this is just some modern art screensaver. It's a very nice...
Okay, well, thank you.